Hey guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in, man. I'm here Monday through Fridays from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. And I got a good one lined up for you today. Rebecca Gordon is going to be on to talk about America's drug war down in Mexico. It's just a nightmare down there. Jesus. You know, America, you're a mean SOB, dude. And Dan Sanchez is going to be on about Google's war against antiwar.com and other anti-horrible things activists. He's got the spotlight today on antiwar.com all about it. Man, he's the brightest shining new star over there at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. If you ask me, runs the Mises Academy there, is doing great work and has written some great stuff for antiwar.com. Most recently, he had a killer piece on America's role in overthrowing the government in Ukraine a year ago. And interviewed him a couple of times, and we've become pretty good friends, I think. Real nice guy. And he's just a really talented writer, too. I really urge you to go to antiwar.com today. Check out that spotlight. Pass it around. This is the kind of article where, even if you're not a foreign policy guy, this is a big deal for anyone who uses the internet. For anyone, especially activists, online activists, liberal, conservative, libertarian, or, you know, commies, fascists, anybody. Al-Qaeda guys? No. Whoever, man. Google is, yeah. They got themselves some problems. We've got ourselves some problems with the Google there. So, please check out Dan's article and share it. It's a really important one. And it's a great read, too, because he's a talented writer, like I say. And then also we're working on trying to get, somebody from the NIAC. Now, I'm under the impression that Trita Parsi and Reza Marashi both are in Lausanne, is that how you say it? Switzerland, at the actual negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal. NIAC, that's the National Iranian American Council. And, but Tyler Cullis, he's the third wheel over there. I don't mean that in a bad way, over there at NIAC, and he's a brilliant guy and a legal scholar, so he understands the technicalities of all the sanctions and stuff real well, and I saw him tweeting some things over the weekend, so we're working on seeing if we can get Tyler Cullis to come on the show today to give us the latest from the Iran talks, which will be our first order of business to discuss today on the show, too. Regardless whether we get him or not, but we're going to try to get Tyler Cullis for you. And then plus I got a ton of news. It's only Monday morning and I've got a list of a ton of people I want to interview already this week. I mean, that may be, if I add them up, that may be every spot available on the show all week long. I've already got decided and the week is still very, very young. But we've got a lot of important news to cover. By the way, Karen Kotowski is going to be on the show tomorrow. I was supposed to interview her Friday before last for the anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War, and something came up and she was unable to do the show that day. It might have just been a time zone difficulty. I'm not sure what happened there, but I don't care. But anyway, I love Karen Kotowski. She's just great, man. Speaking of great writers, she is a great writer. You can find her archive at lourockwell.com. And, yeah, she was the eyeball witness, man, to the neocons lying us into war with Iraq back in 2002 and 2003. Do you know that story? Have you ever read Karen Kotowski? It's a hell of a story. And since all spring long it'll be the anniversary of the start of Iraq War II. I should specify which Iraq War I'm talking about now that we're on our third one. Really our fourth one if you count Bill Clinton's war, and I do. So there's the Gulf War, and then there's Clinton's war, and then there's Junior's war. And now Obama's getting us back in after getting us out. Iraq War 4, maybe, is the best name for it. And it rhymes, too, so it's got that going for it. But yes, no, Iraq War III, or Junior's War, the war for the Ayatollah. Well, the first war for the Ayatollah. Karen, she sat there and watched the neocons lies into war. And she's going to be on the show to tell that story tomorrow. So that'll be great to talk to her again. You know, back in 2012, I went to, was it Miami? No, it was Tampa. Tampa, Florida, the big Ron Paul thingamajig down there during the Ron Paul campaign. And I'll never forget this. I explained to Karen, I guess she didn't know, but I explained to Karen that I had married Larissa Alexandrovna. And she, like, pushed me and goes, oh, boy, well, you got the better part of that deal. And, yeah, she's right about that. Absolutely right about that. Because I guess Larissa, I forget now, but Larissa had written some stories that were based on some interviews with Karen, some of the things that she had learned from Karen. And Larissa had won a big fan in Karen Kotowski after that. And I'll never forget that. It was such a funny moment, you know, where I didn't argue with her either. Hey, what can I do? Argue the point? No, of course not. But I just thought it was funny the way she was perfectly happy to say so. That's all right. That's what they call the humble brag. Yeah, that's right. I'm nobody. I just married the most brilliant and pretty lady in this hemisphere from the other one. All right. The Iran deal. I got to talk to you about the Iran deal. They're doing the damn deal. If they don't do the deal, then I will be disappointed. If they don't do the deal, it is going to be the worst egg on the face of this president and his secretary of state. I mean, they have to succeed politically. They absolutely have to succeed at hammering out a deal. Now, what they're working on is actually not the final deal. It's going to be a 2 or 3 page outline of the final deal that they will still have some technical difficulties to iron out by the end of July, supposedly. But it's more than just an interim deal, too. It's a maybe lowercase f final deal, if you understand. And if they fail, then I will think of John Kerry exactly what I already think of him. And that's bad. But I think it's not just Kerry. We got the entire United Nations Security Council plus Germany, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany working on this deal on our side. And then plus the Iranians on theirs. And the thing of the deal is, first of all, what you need to understand, if you don't already know, and if you're a regular listener to this show, I know you already know, so don't take it personal like I'm calling you a dummy. But if you don't know, the deal is that Iran is a member in good standing of the Non-Proliferation Treaty since the 1970s, since before the revolution, and ever since. And as part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they are mandated to have a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they have one. And they're not in violation of it, and they never have been in violation of it. The agency has continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. Yes, you heard right. They have verified the non-diversion. They have proved the negative. Well, they must not have diverted it because it's all still here. Accounted for by the IAEA. And they're not in violation of that. The only scandalous stuff you hear about them, geez, look at that clock. I can't believe it. Are you guys making the time go faster on me, or I'm just getting older? Is that how it is? The only scandal you hear about is their refusal to cooperate with the IAEA on completely separate, extraneous UN Security Council mandated investigations into already disproven, bogus, so-called possible military dimensions, the so-called alleged studies, which are all just based on Israeli forgeries, and we've known this for years. The smoking laptop is bogus. It was forged by the Israelis and funneled through the Mujahideen Iqbal communist terrorist cult. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Yeah, one good thing about me getting older and or time going faster or whatever's going on here is that the breaks don't last as long. But neither do the segments. All right, it's just my brain is having a problem is all. All right, so listen. Quick side note, it's brought up in the chat room. It's a very good question in the chat room. Is Israel a member of the IAEA? Why, yes, they are. But you know what? They're not members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And of course, they have H-bombs, and it's no longer a secret. It's now officially confirmed even by the Obama government from a FOIA lawsuit by our friend Grant Smith that the Israelis have hydrogen bombs. They've never been members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so they are not mandated under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA. But they're still members of the IAEA to... what purpose, I don't know, other than you can read lies in the New York Times that say, according to information provided by an IAEA member state, yeah, Israel, David Sanger, we can see right through you, you bastard, you liar, you launderer of lies. Oh, look, an IAEA member state said so. Yeah, Israel. And the Mujahideen-y cult, communist terrorist cult. Wow, I'm so impressed. Back to the point. The only scandal about Iran's cooperation with the IAEA is not about their safeguards agreement. There is no scandal there. The only scandal, so-called, is these completely extraneous UN Security Council-mandated inspections of non-nuclear facilities that are not covered by the safeguards agreement whatsoever, and that Iran is perfectly within their right to refuse. No, you can't search all our military bases. No, you can't inspect our missile factories. And then they go, oh, well, we heard you got some testing of some implosion systems out there at Maravan. And the Iranians go, you know what? That's a damn lie, but it's such a explosive accusation. We'll go ahead and welcome you guys out to Maravan to check it out. And then what does the IAEA say? No, thank you. We don't want to disprove our lie. It used to be the IAEA was run by a guy named Mohammed El-Baradei, who is not a liar. Now it's run by a guy named Yukiya Amano, who is a liar, and that's a proven fact. A fact, a scientific truth in the WikiLeaks. Revealed by the American hero, Chelsea Manning, now doing 35 years in the brig for her heroic act of leaking these documents and showing Yuki Amano dishonoring all of his ancestors, laying down on his belly before the American conquerors and saying, hey, whatever lie you want me to tell, I'm here to serve you, not the truth. It's right there in the WikiLeaks. So they like to pretend that there's a scandal where there's not one. But when it comes to their actual mandated job of verifying the non-diversion of declared nuclear material, they continue to do that and they continue to prove the negative. So now that brings us to the question of what's the point of these nuclear talks? The point of the nuclear talks is, from the American point of view, to get extra super double extra happy lucky wish confirmation of the non-diversion. Of the lack of a military dimension to Iran's nuclear program. So expanded inspections, basically. And then on the Iranian side, they want to get the sanctions lifted. Because America's put them under sanctions that are strangling their economy. Crippling sanctions, they call them. As Brad Sherman, congressman from California, said, yes, the point is to wage economic war against the civilians, and I hope they suffer too, he said. No, really, go and look. Yeah, that's right. The enemy are the civilians of Iran. Really? Oh, okay. As long as you're being honest, I guess I'll quote you, Brad. And now, so, but ask the question, because the war party in America keeps saying, oh my God, it's a bad deal. Benjamin Netanyahu told me, his mina bird to repeat, bad deal, bad deal. Oh no, Obama's gonna compromise with the Iranians on a bad deal. Well, what does that mean? That he's gonna let them make nuclear bombs? No. They don't want to make nuclear bombs. They never were making nuclear bombs. The last mean old Ayatollah and the newer, nicer one have both issued religious fatwas as supreme leader of the country that it is haram. It is forbidden by Islam to make weapons of mass destruction. And listen, politicians and especially theocratic ones say a lot of things. I'm not saying take that to the bank, but I'm just saying it. All evidence indicates that that's legit and that the government of Iran has obeyed their commands. They do not have a nuclear weapons program. And you know who agrees with me about that? All 17 American intelligence agencies and Israeli Mossad. Go look it up in Haaretz. They even use the exact phrase of the CIA. We judge with high confidence that Iran has not made the decision to begin to pursue nuclear weapons. Okay, that's the quote from the Israeli Mossad, as well as all of the American intelligence agencies when they come together as one, as the National Intelligence Council, and put out their national intelligence estimate. They first said so in 2007, and they have reaffirmed that conclusion in 2010, 11, and 12, and, you know, I don't know. I don't know if they have an official reconfirmation this year, but same damn difference. They've never contradicted themselves on that. That's the plain truth. So, then the question is, what's the alternative to the deal? Well, the alternative to the deal is Iran continues to build their civilian nuclear program, and America continues to keep Iran under sanctions. I guess forever. And so who benefits there? The right-wing hawks in Israel, America, and Iran. And, you know, they basically what they're trying to do, what the Israelis and the American war party want, is they want these talks to fail. And then they're, I guess, hoping that the Iranians will end up deciding to go ahead and try to make nukes so that then they can justify a war. They're trying to browbeat them, as they successfully did with the North Koreans, as we talked about with John Pfeffer on the show on Friday, to browbeat them until they finally say, fine, screw you guys then, and give up on the non-proliferation treaty, withdraw from it, kick the inspectors out of the country. Then the Israelis and their American fifth column believe that they can force America to do a war there. But if you ask any of these kooks, oh yeah, well then what's supposed to happen? Here's a country that's three times the size of Iraq with four times the population, and it ain't a flat desert. It's all mountains. It's shaped like Colorado on the ground there. America can't win a war there. An air war could degrade their nuclear program, but it can't destroy it. And I don't even think in Bill Kristol's worst fantasy did they have, you know, I don't know, 1 million men marching on Tehran to change the regime. The best that they can try to spin is that the MEK, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq Communist Terrorist Cult, that has 0.00000% report inside Iran, will be the new government there. With Myram Rajavi, who is basically like T from Bo and T of the Heaven's Gate cult, would be the new dictator of Iran, which is, it's not even a pot pipe dream. It's a crack pipe dream. It's completely ridiculous and untrue and couldn't possibly be true ever. So, sign the damn deal. There's no reason not to at all, other than lies. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. But the off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Oh man, I was going to make a great joke, but I forgot. I was going to call my mom, who's fluent, pretty much, and ask her, how do you say blowback in Spanish? I forgot to. So there's my lame non-attempt at a joke there. That's the article. Can you say blowback in Spanish? It's by Rebecca Gordon from TomDispatch.com. We also ran, of course, under Tom's name at antiwar.com. She's the author of the book Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States, and she teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. The website is mainstreamingtorture.org. Welcome back to the show, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm doing just great. It's wonderful to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here, and great to read you, as always. What an incredible piece that you have here, and what a terrible story.
I know.
The parallels, that's kind of where you start the article, is kind of some of the parallels between America's drug war in Mexico and the terror war over in Mesopotamia.
And it's not entirely surprising, considering that the same people are organizing it, and they have basically the same strategy towards any problem, which is, let's shoot guns at it and drop bombs on it.
Right.
It's a little bit strange, not that we're dropping bombs in Mexico, but it really is a bit odd that over and over again we conceive of every problem in this country as something on which we need to make a war. Mm-hmm. And that has been what, you know, other countries consider to be a public health problem, the fact that people are addicted to drugs. We have chosen to treat as a problem of crime, and not only a crime, but a war. So we now, for many years, have had a war on drugs, and in Mexico, it is a real war in which real people die in the tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so we've had a pretty good, but pretty full-scale war on drugs since Nixon, and then especially since Reagan. But then it is kind of a metaphor. It's mostly a criminal problem, but that's really in the United States for the most part. It's also been at least an excuse for intervention throughout Latin America. And, of course, I guess it sort of goes without saying, doesn't it, that virtually all the drug laws of the Latin American states are with an American gun to their government's heads, that you may not decriminalize, you may not legalize, you may not try to find another way out of this. You're going to do it our way. So I guess that's the first part of the question. But then the second part of the question is, when Mexico turned this into a real war in terms of sending out the military to get involved beginning in 2006, was that because of the Bush administration or that was their own policy?
I would say it was a combination of the two, that it was the U.S. absolutely went along with it, but they had as a partner Felipe Calderon, who is was the second president from the right-wing PAN, the National Action Party in Mexico. And he was very happy to go along with the U.S.'s approach. And there was about $2.4 billion to sweeten the deal, which came in something called the Mérida Initiative. Mérida is a city in Mexico where the agreement was signed. And the U.S. has provided $2.4 billion in military aid to Mexico specifically to fight this war. And what's very interesting about this, and my friend John Lindsay Poland has a wonderful story about this that happened to come out. We didn't even know we were each writing a story. His came out the same day at foreignpolicy.org. And in it, he showed where that money went in terms of buying weapons from U.S. companies, including Black Hawk helicopters from Sikorsky. So basically, what's happened is money has been funneled from U.S. taxpayers to the government of Mexico, where I'm sure a bunch was skimmed off, and then back to U.S. arms manufacturers in the United States, mm-hmm. to buy assault weapons, everything from assault weapons and grenade launchers all the way up to helicopters.
Right. You know, it's interesting that I think probably most people, if they just, you know, walk out of a government school somewhere, they might think that it's Mothers Against Cocaine Abuse or up there lobbying for this stuff. But I remember Ron Paul saying that whenever it came to Biden's Plan Columbia and this kind of thing on Capitol Hill, you couldn't find a concerned group of pluralistic American Democrats or Republicans up there, concerned mothers or anything like that. It was simply the helicopter manufacturers are up there saying, hey, listen, this is how we make our money, is spraying Agent Orange on the people of Colombia.
No, that's exactly right. And now it's the people of Mexico and the government of Mexico, which is so completely interpenetrated with the drug cartels that really, in effect, the war is happening inside the Mexican government as well as inside the country of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the article, well over 60,000 people through 2012 and probably another 30,000 after that have died in this war. Now, when my article came out, I received a letter from somebody who lives in Mexico, a U.S. expat, who said, you know, you should realize that these people who've died in this war, they're not just innocent people, right? They're involved in the drug trade. But as is the case in the United States, people who are involved, especially at the lower level, and that's who's getting killed, are people who are forced through economics into what becomes the only game in town, mm-hmm. the only employment in town. And this is one of the ways that the drug trade in Mexico is very similar to what happens in our poor cities and poor communities in this country. It is the only game in town if you want employment. And if you want, in fact, in Mexico, government services. Mm-hmm. So just like ISIS in Iraq, the Sinaloa cartel and the other cartels in the places where they are strong actually provide services and employment for people.
Right. Well, and of course,
the government is failing to do.
Yeah, that argument, of course, it's that same old circular argument. Drugs are wrong because they're illegal, and they're illegal because they're wrong because they're illegal. And just taking for granted that somehow it's a sin to be a marijuana or cocaine businessman when, you know, that's just begging the question. No one has ever proved that there's anything wrong with selling drugs to someone who's a willing buyer. And you can complain about, public health consequences and that kind of thing, like you said, but then all of a sudden you get right back to public health type solutions rather than military ones. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, you and I may differ a little bit about the drug business, but here's where I think we agree, which is that decriminalization is absolutely one essential piece to dealing with this problem. I have friends who live up in rural Vermont where things are very poor, and they've been watching over the last few years how the use of heroin has been expanding in their area. And it's interesting in the ways that heroin seems to be replacing cocaine. And of course, it comes from two main places, Afghanistan and now Mexico. So a lot of the new heroin that's coming into the U.S. is actually being grown and processed in Mexico. Mm-hmm. This is relatively new. And the thing about heroin is it is one of those drugs that people can use for many, many years and still carry on a life. But it's also a drug like other addictive drugs that in some people can be profoundly destructive.
Right. No
but
question
the answer
about that.
To that is a medical answer. It's not to throw people in jail. And so the other piece of this, which you and I have talked about before, is that because of the Rockefeller drug laws, which from New York, which then were copied in states all over the country and were federalized and under which judges are not permitted to decide how long a sentence should be, mandatory minimum sentences, all of those things have gone towards filling our prisons to the point where we have 2.3 million people in jail in this country, literally more prisoners than in any country in the world.
Yeah, 25% of all the prisoners on the planet when we have, out of 7 billion people and we got 300 million. So
yeah.
Anyway, somebody else
it's
do the percentage, not me. All right, I'm sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Rebecca Gordon, writing at TomDispatch.com, and it's also at AntiWar.com. Can you say blowback in Spanish?
1 minute. Well, four.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Rebecca Gordon about her great piece for Tom Dispatch, and also it's under Tom's name, Tom Englehart, that is, at antiwar.com. Can you say blowback in Spanish? And we're talking about America's mandated drug war down in Mexico, and it's just tearing their society apart. As she said, somewhere on the order of maybe even 100,000 people have been killed in this thing. And so now... let me pretend for a minute that I'm a man with a hammer and the drug problem down in Mexico is a nail. I actually saw, as an aside, Bill Clinton apologize to Mexico recently, and he said, you know, we did such a good job of cracking down on drug shipments coming in overseas and through the air that we just made them all run over ground through your country. Sorry. Now, he has no apology for any Americans who have suffered in the drug war this whole time. We can all go screw ourselves, I guess, but... at least he's sorry to the people of Mexico. If I'm a general in the Mexican army and the president comes to me and says, hey, can you smash these cartels? I'm going to say, hell yeah, I've got infantry. We're going to go and we're going to find these guys and we're going to surround them and we're going to shoot them until they're all dead. And that's going to solve our drug problem. And so I know it sounds kind of silly, but in a way it kind of makes sense, right? You shoot a bunch of Zetas till they're dead. There ain't no Zetas no more. So why has it been so ineffective that when they use the Mexican army to try to smash these cartels, Rebecca?
Well, the problem is that the cartels are sort of like an amoeba, and you can smash one piece of it, but they just split off and recreate others. So that, for example, you mentioned the Zetas, and the Zetas are actually a little bit on the decline now. I am not an expert, by the way, on the drug wars in Mexico. I'm not the person, if you want all of the in and out chronology of which group came to the top at which time. But what I can tell you is that the United States and the Mexican government have used a method they call divide and conquer. And so what they've done is basically taken sides in the drug wars. So the United States, the DEA, and the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, have actually been working with fairly high-placed confidential informers in the Sinaloa cartel in order to get information about the other cartels. And they probably took part, it looks like, took real sides in the war between Sinaloa and the Juarez cartel in Ciudad Juarez a few years ago, in which the Sinaloa cartel actually destroyed or beat back the Juarez cartel, leaving about 10,000 people dead in the streets of Juarez. So one of the things that's really clear is that there's this deep interpenetration between our agencies, the Mexican government, and the cartels themselves. Mm-hmm.
You know, I read a New York Times story about Juarez one time where it's funny, it's almost kind of out of the mouths of babes kind of thing, where these idiot DEA guys are saying, you know, it's funny, back in the 70s, all the cocaine was being run by these kind of open shirt, sort of Margaritaville, good time having guys, and we clamped down on them, and the more we clamped down and the more we clamped down over the decades, the meaner and meaner and meaner the drug lords got. And then we killed the top drug boss in Juarez, who ruled all of Juarez. And as soon as we did, his 50 lieutenants all went to war with each other, and all these people all got killed. And then, of course, as you're saying, they're picking sides in that to some degree or another. But, of course, their only answer is, well, I guess we better just work harder at doing the same thing.
And, you know, the U.S. is also providing – It's not just the DEA and the ICE, but actually the U.S. military and the CIA are also working inside Mexico, providing training, and also running a couple of these really ridiculous failed operations, the most famous of which is Fast and Furious. So do you know about Fast and Furious?
Just a little bit, but go ahead and tell them.
All right. So Fast and Furious was this brilliant idea that the United States, instead of stopping assault weapons and grenade launchers from going into Mexico, should actually allow those weapons to go into Mexico. The theory was that we would be able to trace them and that those guns would lead us to the leaders of the big cartels whom we could then arrest. So this was in back in 2010 and 2011. And so you may not know, but there's actually only one legal gun shop in all of Mexico. It's in Mexico City. But along the border of the 2,000-mile border between the U.S. and Mexico, there are 6,700 gun shops. And that's where 70% of the guns that go into Mexico are coming from. And so the U.S. said, okay, well, instead of stopping guns from going into Mexico, let's follow them. Only what happened was they never followed them. They just let the guns go across the border. They kept track of the serial numbers. And then, surprise, surprise, those very weapons turned up in murders over and over again, not only in Mexico, but also back here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And a U.S. Border Patrol agent was actually killed in 2010 by one of those weapons. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about this is that inside Mexico, this Fast and Furious was not approved by the Mexican Congress. It was a secret deal with parts of the Mexican government, but not the whole Mexican government. So in a way, it was subverting the legitimate government of Mexico and the guy who was the attorney general at the time, who knew that it was happening, was this guy named Eduardo Medina. Eduardo Medina later became the Mexico ambassador to the U.S., and then just this past year, in fact, just this past month, he was appointed to be the head of the Supreme Court in Mexico. And people in Mexico are furious about this because they know that he secretly colluded with the U.S. government to allow weapons to come into Mexico that ended up murdering Mexican civilians.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, too, when you talk about all the cooperation, and not just ATF. Oh, a couple of rogue ATF officers went off the reservation or something. But here this huge operation. You have them working, as you said, outright allying with Sinaloa against the Zetas. It's the kind of thing where, in my imagination, if we lived in a normal country in a normal time and we weren't, you know, a world empire at war across the Middle East and this kind of thing, this is the kind of scandal that could bring down the government of the United States of America. What do you mean you guys are the ones arming and allying with the cocaine dealers of Mexico like this? And, you know, when you talk about the guns, we're talking about full autos and 50 calibers and
the kinds
of guns that the local capitalist gun shops would not be selling these men unless they had the U.S. government telling them to do it.
Absolutely. No, I think that's right. And, you know, what's interesting is sometimes they actually do because they worry about their licenses. And that's what happened in the case of Fast and Furious. They actually informed the ATF that, look, there are these purchases that really don't look like they're hunters going out for gazelles. And the ATF said, great, let them go. It's called gun walking. The University of San Diego has a transborder institute, and one of the things they look at is interdiction. They look at the guns that are seized between the U.S. and Mexico. So between 2010 and 2012, about 253,000 guns each year, and you're right, we're talking full-on assault weapons, made it across the border. The Mexican authorities actually stopped almost 13% of those guns. Do you know what percentage the U.S. efforts to stop guns going across the border caught? 2%. In other words, the Mexican government is doing a better job of stopping those guns going across the border than we are, And you have to ask yourself, how hard could it be to stop 253,000 rifles a year crossing the border if you wanted to?
Right. Yeah, it's the same. Then they turn around and complain that the Turks won't stop letting all the guns and Mujahideen across into Syria, you know, when they got the exact same thing going on.
The parallels are really sad.
Oh, man. Well, and so I guess, have things changed in the politics? It's such a horrible failure here. I mean, I could see Americans not getting it, but in Mexico, they understand now. The entire population understands that militarizing the situation has made it that much worse. Are they trying to cool it off now?
Well, not the government, no. The Mexican government is the traditional ruling party of Mexico is now back in power, but that hasn't made any difference in terms of how the Mexican government is approaching this problem. But for the first time, the news from Mexico kind of made it into the United States when the 43 teachers in training from Ayotzinapa were kidnapped back last year and turned over when the mayor of their town, Iguala, turned them over to the police, who turned them over to the drug gangs. We still don't know what happened to them, but it seems very likely that they were murdered. That finally touched off huge demonstrations around the country. And in fact, on November 20th of last year, there was a national strike. And the reason I know this is that was the day I was expected to speak at the Autonomous University of Mexico in the capital city, which is the largest university in Mexico. But I couldn't go because the whole country was on national strike to do something about this violence. People are sick and tired of it.
Yeah, the ones who are still alive.
The problem is impunity.
Right.
The problem, my Mexican friends say the problem is that there is no way to bring these government officials to any kind of account. There is no way to make them pay for their crimes. In fact, they continue running the country. And, you know, if you want to talk about impunity, we have the same problem here where we have war criminals wandering around, Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, who also have gotten away with their murders and tortures with impunity,
right,
just to bring in my favorite subject.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad you did, too. And it's also kind of an ironic note. I don't have a problem with all the immigration in the world. Come on over is my attitude. But, you know, the conservatives in America who are the most concerned about all of the immigration, not just from Mexico, but from all of Latin America. I guess they're all Mexicans to an American conservative.
Right.
They never ask themselves, what am I doing to help destroy their civilization so they have no hope for a decent life whatsoever except to come here? And why would anybody leave their home to come to move far away to another country except because they're desperate?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's, you know, people who study immigration talk about two kinds of factors, push factors and pull factors. So you can figure what the push factors are: war, famine, economic disaster. And you're exactly right. Who would want to leave their home unless there was no better option?
Right.
And that's the reality.
Yep.
I think, you know, we also have to look at how this drug war is increasing the amount of surveillance and the militarization of our own police back here in the United States. And this is something you and I have talked about before.
Right.
But the drug war in the United States is the pretext for giving, well, my local police force in Oakland, armored personnel carriers,
right,
to patrol the streets of East Oakland. If I go a block and a half to 24th Street in Mission, there are the surveillance cameras, supposedly there primarily to protect me from drug gangs.
And by the way, in the chat room, they're asking, all this cooperation with the Sinaloa cartel, does that extend to allowing them to operate inside the United States of America as well?
I don't know the answer to that. I do not have any facts to speak to that. What I do know is that there was at least one case in which the ICE was working with a couple of confidential informants, gave them re-entry visas down in Texas so that they could come back and forth the border easily in order to meet with their contacts in the ICE in Texas. And they use that those visas to move lots of product across the border. But that's a single example. It doesn't mean that there's an organized support there. I can't speak to that. But what I will say is that, you know, those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I'm an old lady, so I'm one of them, you know, when we think about urban gangs, maybe we think about West Side Story and the Sharks and the Jets. This is not the Sharks and the Jets. This is not teenagers who are bonding together because they have nowhere else to turn. The gangs in my city, in most cities around the country that are big cities, these are part of an international business that is run with guns, and which is so that once the kids get caught up in it, they have no out. And I've been watching this happen actually to a young man who is somebody that my church works with, and he tried to get out of the gun life and the drug life, and they murdered his fiance. It's not, you know, these are not just groups of young people getting together anymore. This, and well over half the people in gangs nowadays are not teenagers, they're adults. Right. It's a big business. And, you know, one thing I didn't talk about in the story, because, again, this is not my area of expertise, is what are the solutions. But there are some pretty obvious ones. Decriminalization, ending the mandatory minimum, doing something to open up our prisons. Also, the Ban the Box campaign, which you may have heard of, which is the idea that when companies are hiring people, they should not have that box you have to check that says, have you ever been convicted of a crime? That should not be an entry-level question to getting a job, and that it should only be a question for jobs where it's actually relevant to the job the person is going to do, so that people can actually, once they get out of prison, have a chance of reestablishing a life. Mm-hmm. You know, Portugal has a 12-year experiment going, in which they decriminalized drugs in their country, and they began treating drug problems as a drug addiction as a public health issue. And a lot of people said, well, if you do that, first of all, Portugal is going to fill up with every drug addict in Europe, and secondly, you're going to have hugely increased amounts of drug addiction. What they found was the exact opposite, right, that they have lower prison population and they have many fewer people with addiction problems than they did before they decriminalized. Right. Uruguay is a country that has actually resisted U.S. pressure, at least as far as marijuana goes, and they legalized marijuana last year. And as far as I know, the country has not yet exploded.
Right.
So,
well, we've seen too that ever since they've legalized, just in a few states here in America, the growing and cultivation of pot, that's put all the pot businessmen in Mexico out of business. They're now importing American weed because it's better.
Really? I had not heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, complaining, oh, man, legalization is really hurting us. It's just like the old thing about bootleggers and Baptists, right, for Prohibition back then. Pretty obvious why the cartels want it to stay illegal. That's where they get their artificially high profit margins.
On the other hand, when it comes to meth, it's the Mexican cartels that are putting the local homebrew people out of business, which is probably not a bad thing, frankly. But
the only reason anybody's addicted to meth is because cocaine is so artificially expensive. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have a meth epidemic in the first place. But
it's interesting because cocaine importation has also decreased tremendously in the U.S. and some people think that it's being replaced with heroin. I think you may be right that it's more likely it's being replaced with meth. And the deal is that apparently in Mexico they can get the precursor chemicals from China, and they are purer and makes it easier to make meth in Mexico than in the United States.
Right. I'm sorry. We got to go, Rebecca. We're all out of time. I've kept you way over time through the top of the hour here, but really got to go. But thank you so much for your time. It's just been great as always.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You too. All right, y'all, that's Rebecca Gordon from TomDispatch.com. It's also running at antiwar.com. This one is called Can You Say Blowback in Spanish? Her website is mainstreamingtorture.org, and that's also the name of her book, Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. We'll be right back with Danny Sanchez in just a sec. Oh, we're already back on again. We'll be right back with Danny Sanchez right now, in fact. Hang on one second. Let me see if I can get him on the line here. That's one good thing about Skype. I don't have to stop and dial a phone number. All right. I just got off with, I guess you heard, I just finished up with Rebecca Gordon there. So you guys will have to check the archives for the rest of that interview. Got another good 4 or 5 minutes out of her after the break there. So that you missed. So that'll be all at scotthorton.org/interviews. And next up is our friend Dan Sanchez. He's also writing today at antiwar.com. Let me recommend to you his last one that's over there on the blog about Ukraine. That is just excellent. But this one is called Don't See Evil, Google versus antiwar.com, or that's Eric's title for it. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. Dan, how are you doing? Oh, did I hit the wrong button? No, I didn't. Did you hit the wrong button? You may have. Or maybe I got a problem with my Skyper. Well, Danny, is it you or me? What do you think? I'll tell you what, I got your number. I'm going to try to call you because Skype is failing us at this moment, and that's no good. Well, let me think of a good soundbite to play for you guys. I guess I could pipe in some Fox News for you, but I don't want to do that. Make you hate my guts. Let's try. Dan, are you there? Can I hear you? I cannot hear you. Okay. Soon as my soundbite player gets going here, I'm going to find something to play for you. Something long enough. Something good enough.
Ground zero. So this is where the first guy got AIDS.
Peter, this is the site of the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Oh, so Saddam Hussein did this?
No.
The Iraqi army?
No.
Some guys from Iraq?
No.
That one lady who visited Iraq that one time?
No, Peter, Iraq had nothing to do with this. It was a bunch of Saudi Arabians, Lebanese, and Egyptians financed by a Saudi Arabian guy living in Afghanistan and sheltered by Pakistanis.
So you're saying we need to invade Iran?
Now that the war is over, and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick right in the heart of that world and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this. Okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia.
You guys were totally out of control.
It's a job for peace officers.
Oh, man, it wasn't supposed to do that. Stupid thing. All right, hang on one second, guys. Let me see if I can get Dan here. I got to find something to play for you so that it ain't dead air. Nope, that's got cuss words in it. Oh, I know. Here. Here's Victoria Nuland on CNN.
In Kyiv itself, some of the barricades around the Maidan have come down, but you can't compare the situation in Kyiv, where now everything that is still being held by protesters is being held with licenses and with the agreement of the government of Ukraine, with the agreement of the Rada, or with regular leases from the owners of the building, which is, you can't compare that to what's happening in eastern Ukraine, where you have armed separatists wearing baklavas, carrying very heavy
baklava?
pause. What in the hell is she talking about?
Isn't that going to get all sticky? Allow monitors in,
I can't believe that this person is actually a person. I can't believe that Robert Kagan is in love with her, though. For some reason, that just sounds plausible enough. But otherwise, it is almost unbelievable that this cartoon character is actually a character in actual time and space, if you know what I mean. All right, anyway. We're way late to get Dan Sanchez on the line here. Oh, now we've got an echo on the line. Dan, are you on speakerphone or something? Oh, we've got technical problems interviewing Dan today all over the place, y'all. Good.
No.
Echo. Now, even worse. I don't know. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to try to call him back, and then maybe that'll work. I got to hit that button, and then I hit that button. Then I hit that button. Don't See Evil is the name of the article. Boy, you know, I think this is going to end up being a one-segment interview. Hey, you there? Yeah. I'm going to call you back on your cell, dude. All right. Well, hell. You know what? I'm just going to go ahead and blab for a minute until the break, and then I'll get him on the line. Because this just ain't working out for us, guys. The article is Don't See Evil. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. There's no point in bringing him on to get just through the intro and then, you know, whatever. So we'll just have, it'll be okay. We'll get a good 10-minute interview out of Dan Sanchez here in just a minute. So here, let me introduce you to this news story in case you don't know, and I don't know anything else about it other than that it's breaking news, and that is that a man has been shot dead after attempting to attack NSA headquarters, they claim. Now, you know, they shot that poor woman dead and claimed that she was trying to ram the barricade at the White House, but they were liars and they were lying and they murdered this poor, innocent, helpless woman. So just because the government claims that somebody tried to ram a gate doesn't make it true. Innocent until proven guilty. That's my standard. On the other hand, I think I saw a headline that said that there were two men in the truck, not a lone kook. Two men were working together doing it, that they were dressed as women somehow. One of them was shot dead. An attack on the gate. Now, I have to tell you, my first impression, if somebody tells me, and I accept for the sake of argument, that somebody tried to attack the NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, I think it's got to be one of two things. It's got to be either a lone nut or 20 guys with rifles who have a plan and know what they're doing. How did two people think that they're going to succeed in doing anything to attack the National Security Agency at Fort Meade? You think that those guards don't all have guns full of bullets? Or what? I don't know how that even makes sense. I'm not talking about right or wrong. I'm just talking about how does it even make sense? Now, initial report says that there were two vehicles, but I think that was probably a misunderstanding. Just because two cars were damaged doesn't mean that there were two cars involved in the attack. I really don't know the latest here. But at least one person was shot and apparently killed in an alleged attempted attack today at National Security Agency headquarters. So I guess it'll be interesting to find out what's behind that. I just don't know. And as long as I got half a second here, let me refresh Laura Rosen's blog, Twitter feed. She's reporting from Switzerland on the talks here. There is no draft. They're still working on it. Some positive spin coming out. But not too much. Oh, is it over? Oh, that's not good. We had not tangible progress in this round. That's kind of a funny thing to say. I don't know what the hell's going to happen. But Laura Rosen with a Z is on Twitter. L. Rosen. At L. Rosen. And she's a pretty damn good reporter, and she's in Switzerland reporting on the talks if you want to follow her for the latest, a writer for Al Monitor. Hey.
Hello?
Hey, there you are.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. Did you change something?
Hello.
You can't hear me?
I can't hear anything.
Can you hear me? Check, check, check. All right, your settings are messed up, dude.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at DarrensCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. DarrensCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. DarrensCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, a little bit of technical difficulties, but no big deal. We got Dan Sanchez on the line. He runs the Mises Academy at Mises.org, and he's written this great article. It's at Medium.com. Don't See Evil, Google's Boycott Campaign Against War Photography and alternative media. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. And for good reason, it's about Google versus antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Dan. How are you?
Great. Great to be with you, Scott.
Good, good. Happy to talk to you again. Go ahead and break us down the facts of the case first for us, please.
Well, first of all, the administrator and founder of antiwar.com, Eric Garris, got an email from Google AdSense letting him know that all of their ads were disabled. Now, these ads are a crucial part of the revenue stream of any popular website that uses ads. And the reason that was given was Abu Ghraib photos. So it wasn't over some sort of gore for the sake of gore. These were photos that are common knowledge and that are huge news. They're incredibly important for the American public, for one thing, because they represent horrible state violence that has been inflicted on people with our tax money and in our name, and for another thing, that it is terrorism-inducing. This kind of abuse enrages people, just like it did in Paris. One of the attackers in the recent Paris attack was actually radicalized by learning about the Abu Ghraib abuses. And the people who defend these abuses actually completely acknowledge the fact that it induces terrorism because they cite that as an excuse for blocking the release of such photos. And so not realizing that that's an excellent reason for not committing these abuses in the first place, but also not realizing that even without the release of these photos, that that people, word would get out among Iraqis and among Muslims in general that these abuses are happening. And so really, these kinds of photos are important because ultimately they reduce terrorism, because they make people, the American public, so disgusted about it that they demand that the abuses stop. And that is most important, that the abuses stop, so they stop triggering terrorism, but also just for the sake of not abusing people. And one of the PR guys answered back to a query of Eric Garris saying that, well, you know, these pictures, they just need to be okay to be seen by any child in any region of the world, which is just baffling because you have to wonder, what does that mean? Like, what are you talking about? Are you talking about these websites being, G-rated now? Are you talking about any region of the world that are allies, that we don't want to offend our allies? Like, does it matter the identity of the victims or victimizers? And what's troubling is that this is a widespread problem. It's not just antiwar.com. For example, Mint Press News, which is another anti-war website, they had to blur their Abu Ghraib photos because of similar objections from AdSense. The American Conservative had to disable ads on its articles because of an objection from Google AdSense over pictures of U.S. troops urinating on horses. It goes beyond AdSense. It's Google's YouTube has been doing this kind of thing, too. The website We Are Change had all of its YouTube videos demonetized. And the reason that it gave for the demonetization is that there were two ISIS videos. And these ISIS videos didn't even have any gore at all. The reason that they gave was that it is sensitive material. And again, you have to ask, whose sensitivities are you protecting here exactly? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not banning ISIS coverage on all sites, but it seems that We Are Change, you know, they're a very anti-establishment, anti-government and regime site. So is it their messages that they're objecting to? And there are instances with the Corbett Report, with Ben Swan's videos, all this kind of stuff. This is happening in a widespread basis. Mm-hmm. And this is really important because war photos have played a crucial role in turning the public against war. And the warmongers know this. They still complain about the Vietnam syndrome, which was especially with pictures like of the naked Vietnamese child running from a napalm attack. These kind of pictures played a big role in turning the American public against the Vietnam War in particular and against war in general, so that after the Vietnam War, what they call the Vietnam syndrome was this anti-war sentiment, with likening it to as if it was a psychological disorder. But by the time of the Gulf War, they were ready to control the imagery. And so really what you saw in the Gulf War imagery were sort of like an Atari video game, like blips on the screen of aerial bombardments of Baghdad, like it's a video game or something, and these quote-unquote precision strikes of these crosshair videos of missiles, like practically going down the chimney, they'd like to have us believe, of exactly who they want to kill. And so because of that kind of sanitized coverage, the Gulf War was really popular. And President George H.W. Bush even exulted in his victory speech that we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. And it's happened with the post-9/11 wars, too. That they really try to control that as well, especially through the embedded journalism program, where they lure journalists with access in exchange for them submitting to censorship. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't even let, until 2009, the flag-draped coffins that were returning from the war zones be photographed.
All right, now let me stop you for just a second, Dan, because we're short on time here, but I want to get to, I mean, you've clearly made the case why the government doesn't want us to see these pictures, because, well, geez, if what we're doing causes harm, then people might begin to object and that kind of thing. But what does Google care? Why would Google do what they're doing now?
Well, yeah, like you'd expect, it would be exactly what a company that was deeply concerned with the government's goals to do. And indeed, as it turns out, that Google is actually deeply connected with the government. Julian Assange has a book called When Google Met WikiLeaks, and he has this chapter that's online called Google is Not What It Seems, where he really lays out how deeply connected Google is with the State Department, with the White House, with it's a huge defense and intelligence contractor now. General Alexander, then head of the NSA, referred to Google as a key member of the defense industrial base, which is security state newspeak for military industrial complex, of course. And Google even helped to drum up support for the air war against Syria that Obama and Kerry wanted. It used its Google front page, the most popular page on the internet, that to actually advertise a Google Hangout section where Kerry was basically lying people into war, because he used this Hangout section to tell the debunked lie that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons against people. And as it turns out, that there's been Pentagon and intelligence community involvement from Google from the very beginning, that Sergey Brin's research at Stanford was actually funded and overseen by a project that was meant to seed research that would be helpful for information warfare for the government, that was set up by the Pentagon and the intelligence community. And this was detailed by the investigative journalist Nafis Ahmed, and he totally proves it. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's in the document. It's actually in Sergey Brin's footnote about who was backing this research. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back to the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, I sure hope that that the audience will do their best to help to make this article viral, because this is important to any kind of political activist, not necessarily just anti-war people. But if Google, it's not the government, but as you say, it's pretty close to them, and it has such a dominant position in the market that this can be really decisive for so many people, so many activist groups fighting for this, that, or the other cause. I mean, this has just got to be important to every freedom-loving American. So everyone, please go find this article. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Don't See Evil by Dan Sanchez about Google's war against antiwar.com, and help do what you can to tweet it out, put it up on Facebook, send it to your friends on your email list, and let's see if we can really break into even TV news here with this, because this is just huge. And thank you, Dan. Not just for your time on the show, but for the great work that you've done on this article here. It's a really important one and very well done.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. That's Dan Sanchez, y'all. He teaches Mises Academy at Mises.org, and he's the author of this great article, Don't See Evil, Google's Boycott Campaign Against War Photography and Alternative Media. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. We'll be right back with Tyler Cullis in just a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Radio Network, Monday through Friday, noon to 2. And also you can find the full interview archive and the rest of it all at scotthorton.org. Our next guest is Tyler Cullis from NIAcouncil.org. That's the National Iranian American Council. Welcome back to the show, Tyler. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us here, especially on short notice as you are. I don't know about you, but I'm all pins and needles over here, man, for this nuclear deal. I know it's not, well, I don't know. It's not, am I right? It's not quite the final deal, but if they sign it, it's sort of the maybe lowercase f final deal here before they have a few more maybe technical details to work out. But if they can come to an agreement today or tomorrow, then it's on. We got a nuclear deal with Iran. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's correct. I mean, this is effectively the deal. In the same way that the Joint Plan of Action in November 2013 was the deal, and the technical annexes that followed in the month after were kind of an afterthought. Something similar will be the case here. There is a deal to be had in the next couple of days, and then the negotiating parties can fill out the details, but a deal for all intents or purposes is on the table, ready to be signed within the next couple of days.
All right, good deal. And Yeah, it's interesting. I'm trying to follow as many of these journalists in Switzerland on Twitter as I can, and there's a mix of very positive statements and I wouldn't say any very negative ones. There's some that are trying to kind of downplay the optimism a little bit, but you're pretty confident they're ready to go at this point, huh?
I mean, the anticipation for a deal is certainly reaching peak levels. And with that comes the hope that the parties will get a deal. It comes a lot of uncertainty. You have a lot of people who want to fabricate a crisis at this late stage of the game. I think it's important to realize how far the parties have come since, summer of 2013, in which bilateral negotiations between Iran and the United States were viewed as historic, are now so banal. They take place a few times every day in Lausanne. There's just two outstanding issues remaining that if you took a long view at it, would be minor issues in the negotiations. And those have to do with the pace at which the United Nations Security Council sanctions imposed on Iran will be relieved. And the second being the scope of what Iran will be permitted in terms of research and development on more advanced and efficient centrifuges. You know, those are two relatively minor details in the, in the tangled web of all the details that need to be filled out. So the parties have reached compromise on so many of the issues that I find it hard to believe that at this late stage, those two minor items would pose an obstacle to the party signing a deal.
Mm-hmm. And now, one of the things that the war party is making a big deal out of is that apparently the American side, and I guess the Americans are the hawks on this, anything would be good enough for Russia and China at this point. And I guess the French are no longer obstructing, they say. They're willing to, and the Brits and the Germans, they're willing to go along with the Americans. They have the harshest position staked out here to be resolved on behalf of Israel, really. But the war party is saying, oh, no, they want to let the Iranians keep a centrifuge facility at Fordo, at Qom, the one that's buried under the mountain. It'll be really hard to hit with high explosives if we ever feel like it.
Yeah, I mean, this problem was something of an intractable one, but it seems to have been resolved. And what we've been hearing out of Lausanne was that the way it's resolved is that Iran would be allowed to continue operating a few hundred centrifuges. However, uranium hexafluoride would not be fed into the centrifuges. Instead, you would put into them other chemical compounds that have a stable isotope that can be separated out. So there would be some research and development occurring at Fordo, but it wouldn't be research and development that would pose a proliferation problem. I think that was kind of an ingenious solution. People might scream about it because they see the headline, hundreds of centrifuges being allowed at Fordo, but the mere fact that centrifuges exist says nothing about whether they pose a proliferation problem or not. Mm-hmm. If they're being fed chemical compounds other than uranium hexafluoride, then, the proliferation concern is eased considerably. So this is a win-win, I think, for the Iranians and for the Americans on the issue.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it sure seems like the Iranians actually only built that Fordo facility and started enriching up to 20% there. Well, I mean, I know they needed some 20% for their targets, for their medical isotope reactor that Nixon and Ford gave them back in the 70s. But it seemed like mostly it was a bargaining chip. They built it so that they could give it up or, at least negotiate away the pretended scary part of it, that they were enriching a stockpile of uranium-235 up to 20% 235, even though it's got to be above 90% to be weapons grade anyway. But that became a big talking point for the war party here, but it also became something like they were just building up a bargaining chip so that they could trade it away. Is that about right, you think?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that's the real success of this of these negotiations, is the fact that for the past decade, both parties undertook action to be used as bargaining chips. For the United States, it was imposing more and more sanctions on Iran. For the Iranians, it was developing their nuclear program in ways that, were not necessarily necessitated, such as building at Fordo and, enriching up to 20% and other items. But both parties have stepped back and realized, you know what, the escalatory cycle was only leading us to war. What we need is something a bit different here. And we've seen that happen. The de-escalation, I think, has been a real success.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, in terms of the sanctions, we got, I guess, three different sets of sanctions. We've got American sanctions, we've got EU sanctions, and we've got UN sanctions. And can you describe these at all, or can you describe what you know so far of what is to be lifted and how soon if this deal is reached?
Yeah, I mean, for the Iranians, the United Nations Security Council sanctions mean a lot. And they mean a lot because for the Iranians, that was the introduction of this problem altogether. The UN sanctions came first in 2006, then in 2007. So before U.S. secondary sanctions were imposed, before the EU sanctions had taken effect. So for the Iranians, they have special meaning. Their effect is little on the ground. The real substantial sanctions are the ones imposed by the Americans, especially the ones that target foreign entities doing business in Iran. So the extent to which the Iranians can win early relief from U.S. sanctions, I think, is the most important and it's the most key. And from what I've heard, the United States is willing to offer substantial economic relief at the front end of a deal. And on that issue, I think the parties have come to a resolution. I think it's only the United Nations Security Council sanctions that remain outstanding, and that's really a symbolic issue rather than an issue in which the United States and its European partners are withholding from Iran actual economic relief.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's funny. Stephen Walt wrote, I don't know, about a year ago or something about how ironic it was that everybody who's not concerned about Iran's nuclear program, because we recognize the truth that it's a civilian safeguarded nuclear electricity program and it's not a nuclear weapons threat in the first place, we're the ones who want a deal so bad. And everybody who's pretending that there's a nuclear weapons threat here, they're the ones who are trying to undermine the deal, because I guess they would prefer that Iran eventually end up with nuclear weapons. But I wonder whether you think we're almost out of time for this segment, but I wonder whether you think that if this deal falls through, that there's a real threat that Iran would then turn around and decide that maybe they do need nukes after all.
I mean, I think the threat is that both sides would return to the escalatory cycle. And in doing so, you know, Iran would be tempted to break out for a nuclear weapon in the same way that the United States would be tempted to go to war. And thankfully, both parties have avoided that outcome thus far.
All right. Now we got to hold it right here and take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm talking with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. They're the peace lobby pushing for a deal between America and Iran on their civilian, already been safeguarded all along, electricity, nuclear electricity program. And the negotiations ongoing in Switzerland right now. Let me ask you a couple of things about these sanctions here, Tyler. First of all, could you describe the effect of these so-called crippling sanctions on the people of Iran over the last few years, as the Obama administration especially has ratcheted them up, and I guess the UN too, has ratcheted them up in order to attempt to pressure the Iranians into doing this deal?
I mean, I think the most troubling effect of the sanctions, and also an intended effect in some regards, was really ostracizing Iran's banks from the global financial system in such a way that Iran was unable to export really basic commodities such as medicines, parts to make their own medicines. Since Iran produces a lot of its own medicines, it wasn't able to import some of the parts necessary to do so. And that led to things like medical shortages, especially for some kinds of cancer treatments and other serious diseases that Iranians went without for a good period of time. These issues were brought up in the UN Special Rapporteur report time and again that Iran was unable to procure necessary medicines in the size that it needed. And this, you know, this had its effect. And, you know, the U.S. didn't target Iran's ability to import medicine, but it was an unintended effect of ostracizing Iranian banks and making it almost impossible for Iranian importers to import goods from outside the country.
Yeah. And now, boy, intended. I mean, I know that they would have never outright said, yeah, you know what we should do is we should starve the Iranian people of medicine. The civilian population of this nation of millions of chemotherapy, of other absolutely necessary drugs. But they know that that's what's going to happen if they, you know, for intents and purposes, shut down this kind of international trade. And we've heard these reports now for, I don't know, at least a couple of years that this is one of the effects. But I guess they just think, well, good.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there was... If there is an area of fault, it's the fault that there was an easy solution to the issue. And it was a solution that we at NIAC presented time and again, which is to create a direct financial channel between the United States and Iran for transactions permitted under U.S. sanctions, which include humanitarian goods like medicine. That would have resolved the problem overnight. The fact that the administration, and especially the U.S. Treasury Department, chose not to take that is troubling because it signals a kind of indifference to the problem.
Well, and it shows too that, you know, it's pretty easy to imagine how businessmen would think, you know what, even if the kind of trade that I'm doing is not banned, I just don't want to mess with this at all, because going up against the U.S. Treasury is suicide for any business on the planet. So, you know what, we're just going to have to figure out something to do other than trading with the Iranians, even if it's stuff that's not on the boycott list whatsoever, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And that's what makes absurd some of the statements from Iran hawks that the sanctions regime has collapsed during the negotiations. If you talk to a European exporter who exported goods to Iran, say, in 2005, they're totally uninterested in resuming business and trade with Iran because of the effect of U.S. secondary sanctions. They know the kind of enforcement power that the U.S. Treasury Department has, and there's real reticence to engage in that kind of trade.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so what about can you break down about Obama's waivers and which sanctions? I mean, I guess the EU and the UN sanctions are sort of a separate issue here, but then on the U.S. sanctions, there are some that Obama can temporarily waive, but he can't completely repeal by himself, and then there are others that he absolutely needs Congress to repeal, correct?
Yeah, so he needs Congress to repeal the sanctions. He can, I think this is the perspective of the White House, is that the White House has a lot of room to maneuver. So each sanctions legislation has granted the president authority to suspend the operation of sanctions. So that's one thing that we can expect. He will start by suspending the operation of the sanctions. He can also license otherwise prohibited transactions, which is both an express and an implied power granted to the president, and he can take parties off what is known as the specially designated nationals list. So this is a list that takes into account parties for which trade is prohibited. By removing Iranian entities from that list, parties in Europe and Asia can start trading with them once again. So these are, you know, from the perspective of the White House, these are substantial powers, and Congress will have a role at the later stages of a deal in which repeal is necessary. But until that time, the expectation is that this will be significant economic relief offered to the Iranians.
Well, I guess the hope is that once they got the deal, then that really shifts all the politics to the president's side here. And especially because it's not just a bilateral deal. We're talking about the entire United Nations, the permanent membership of the Security Council, plus Germany, and, blessed and ratified by United Nations Security Council resolution on top and all this. And so at that point, even though the Republicans control both houses and they put Israel first, obviously, on all of these things, it'll be much harder for them to resist the president to try to threaten to override his veto and this kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, we've seen polling already in which the American people, by almost 2-to-1 numbers, will support a nuclear deal of the kind that the president is negotiating with Iran.
Even and Republicans, by a supermajority, support these talks, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, this is, you know, there's a bipartisan consensus in favor of the deal being negotiated. And, you know, these, I mean, especially once the administration has a deal and feels comfortable enough to sell that deal, you know, it's going to be a game changer. So, you know, we're looking forward to tomorrow in the hopes that a deal is reached and we can start to see the White House do that kind of outreach and start aggressively, you know, defending this deal before Congress and before the public.
Right on. Okay, now, so on the other side of this, the I guess one of the keys is the Iranians are going to open up non-nuclear facilities to inspections by the IAEA. Is that right? Or what can you describe the expansion of the sanctions that are of the inspections that are expected here?
I mean, it is unclear the scope of the inspections and verification regime. It will undoubtedly include, you know, you'll undoubtedly see inspections akin to those permitted under the additional protocol to the IAEA. Mm-hmm. There'll probably be some additional protocol plus type inspections. I wouldn't expect Iran to agree to snap inspections of facilities that are military sites for the sensible reason that, you know, Iran does not want international inspectors going around its military facilities. I mean, but to be honest, I don't think this is a real. I think the Iranians have demonstrated that they're interested in showing transparency over their nuclear program, and I think this is an issue that, at least in discussions I've had with both parties, that you know this will not be a sticking point in the talks at all.
Great. And now, so yeah, I mean, we've seen recently where the IAEA said that they had some concerns about some possible outdoor implosion system testing in western Iran out at Mehrevan, and the Iranians said, hey, come on out. And this is separate from these negotiations. They said, come on out and take a look, and the IAEA refused their invitation. So it doesn't seem like they're worried about hiding anything at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the trouble is that the IAEA has, in some respects, took up work for which it is not well suited. You know, it does accounting. It takes stock of nuclear materials inside of a country and determines whether the reported amount of those nuclear materials is the same as what they're finding on the ground. So when it alleges that Iran is possibly engaged in, there's possible military dimensions to Iran's program at undisclosed locations, you know, this isn't the IAEA's specialty. And I think they've got themselves stuck in a mess where they're going to have to resolve the questions on PMDs to save face, but hopefully to do so without causing a disruption in whatever negotiation is agreed to.
All right, everybody, that's Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council. Thanks to you and Reza and Trita and everybody for all your great work on this issue, Tyler. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And your time on the show as well. All right, y'all. NIAcouncil.org. Cross your fingers. Let's see if we can get this thing done. I'll be back here tomorrow at noon Eastern time.